He has preamble here, preamble or title. In other words, what the first section does is introduce the one who is making the treaty, the great king. Secondly, historic approval. Thirdly, stipulation. These are divided into two categories, basic and detailed. The stipulation. That's important. In the treaty, you get usually some sort of general statement that sort of sums up the obligations of the vassal toward the Susan. In broad general terms, the essence of the obligation, the basic obligation. Then you get the detailed things that spell out matters of detailed provisions in warfare and what the responsibility for the vassal is towards the suzerain in all kinds of ways. Fourthly, you get witnesses, especially blessings and curses. And those are the standard elements. In some treaties, there are other elements, such as provision for deposit of a copy of the document in the sanctuary of the great king as well as the vassal, provision for periodic reading, things of that sort. But the standard elements of the treaty document are those. And of course, the general parallel becomes rather apparent. Fourthly, as far as crime ceases, Klein says that to take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the book's own representation of consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. To take it as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the representation of the book itself, that it consists in a series of addresses of Moses to the people on the plains of Moab. Klein says on page 29, Treaty of the Great King, to analyze Deuteronomy in terms of a documentary pattern is not incompatible with the obvious fact that the book, according to its own representations, consists almost entirely of a series of addresses. For the specific kind of document in view would be orally proclaimed to the vassals at the covenant ceremony. So he takes Deuteronomy as the libretto of the covenant ceremony, sometimes including the response of the vassal, as well as the declarations of the suzerain. In other words, here you have a ceremony of covenant renewal, and Deuteronomy records what went on there. You have the address of Moses to the people, you have the response, in certain instances, of the vassal. So he says, when we identify Deuteronomy as a treaty text, we are also recognizing it as the ceremonial words of Moses. It's the libretto of a covenant ceremony, as he puts it. To take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document is not incompatible with the book's representation of, its own representation of, consisting of a series of addresses of Moses. In other words, you obviously find that in the book of Deuteronomy, a series of addresses. But that's not incompatible with finding this structure and of coming to the conclusion that what is happening is a renewal of the covenant in this, on this occasion. Yeah.
What did you say about the
yeah.
About the ceremonial
Yeah, let's see. His words were, the treaty document, that is Deuteronomy, was thus the libretto of the covenant ceremony, sometimes including the response of the vassal as well as the declarations of the suzerain. Now, is that what you were after or something else? Oh, when therefore we identify Deuteronomy as a treaty text, this is what you asked. We are also recognizing it as the ceremonial words of Moses. In other words, you have a ceremony involved here. And what went on in that ceremony, you have the text of that, the words that were spoken, written down and embodied in the book of Deuteronomy. Yeah.
Then would Klein feel that if this is a ceremonial reading and response, that there is another document behind Deuteronomy would be the answer to
that? Which would be, well, the other document behind Deuteronomy would be the material that comes from Sinai, because the covenant was initially established at Sinai. And at Sinai, you of course get, as far as a document is concerned, primarily you get the Ten Commandments and the table of the law, but you get a lot of other legal material that was given to Moses. The pattern in Exodus is not as easily traced. But when you take Exodus 19 and Exodus 24, you have ceremony involved with the ratification and establishment of the covenant at Sinai, in which most all these elements are present. So you can find these elements back there at the establishment of the covenant. It becomes much clearer, though, as far as structure in Deuteronomy, where you come to a renewal of the relationship which previously had been established. Now, I think in all this, you have to keep in mind that you don't have any slavish copying of some Hittite treaty by Moses, but you have a pattern or form that was familiar to people in the world at that time. And it seems that when God spoke to Moses and structured his relationship to his people and entered into covenant with his people, that this was done generally in a pattern that was familiar. And there were certainly elements of what went on in establishing relationships between, in the political realm, between great kings and their vassals that appear, of course, on a different level and a different content. But those formal elements you find reflected in the covenant material. So that you have to allow for great latitude and difference, and I don't think that the procedure is so much to start from the Hittite treaty and try to force this pattern either on Deuteronomy or on the Exodus material. I think far more significant thing is start with the biblical material, and you pretty soon become aware that in the covenantal sections of the Old Testament, you find certain elements constantly reappearing, historical prologues, blessings and curses, those kinds of things. So you have a, what I would call, covenant form within the Old Testament that is discernible, and you can delineate it. Whether you ever even knew about this or not, leave that out. But then you have this covenant form. Then I think from that you can ask the question, well, where's the origin of this? Where did it come from? What background may there be to it? And this then becomes a subject, I think, never again. But more in that direction than trying to take the form and force it on biblical material. Yeah.
In reference to what you said before about the oral words of Moses, would it then be safe to say that if you were going to attach to this the treaty form in those days, then you would also have to say that it would give weighty evidence to the fact that this was spoken by Moses. It was something that was an oral address. Is this how treaties were done? They were spoken orally and then written down?
Well, probably both. In other words, the great king would draw up a treaty and send his representative to come and read that to the people with whom he was concluding his treaty, so that you'd have the oral and the written both. Now, with Moses, we'll get into this a little bit further along. I think that you could say at Sinai, Of course, he read all those laws to the people, too, and it was also written. You have the oral and the written. When you come to Deuteronomy and covenant renewal, there's certain modification and updating. You're in a new situation. They've been through the wilderness now. They're going to enter the land of Canaan. Moses is going to die. And there's a transition in leadership involved. And Klein focuses on that transition in leadership. We'll get to that in a minute. That's really the focal point and reason for this covenant renewal ceremony in the plains of Moab. Because Moses, so to speak, was the representative of the great king before the people. And Moses now is going to disappear. Succession becomes involved. And when succession was involved in the treaty relationship, in the political realm, frequently there's evidence that you updated and renewed the treaty arrangement and ceremony to make sure with the transition in leadership that there was transition in the relationship and that everything was kept in order. So that that succession becomes an important element in this. And then you get an updating and a change. Number five, just a brief notice at this point. We're going to discuss this in more detail later, too. When Klein says that our point four, to take Deuteronomy as a covenant renewal document, is not incompatible with the book's own representation, series of addresses as Moses, and we speak then of Deuteronomy as the ceremonial words of Moses. Number five, then, there's a formal similarity here between Klein's approach and von Rad's approach.
Formal.
A formal similarity. In other words, von Rad also says that there is a ceremonial, a cultic background to the structure of Deuteronomy. And if you remember, we discussed that, and I'm going to come back to it. But von Rad sees a structure in Deuteronomy. He feels it's a unity. He says, what's the reason for it? Well, there's some ceremonial, cultic background to that. The book is a reflection of a cultic ceremony of some sort. Well, Klein, in a sense, is saying the same thing. You have a covenant renewal in the plains of Moab, and the structure of addresses and flow of thought and so forth of that covenant renewal ceremony is reflected in the book of Deuteronomy, and that in turn reflects this treaty structure. There's a similarity in von Rad's and Klein's argument, however, and that's the important difference, von Rad does not honor the integrity of the book. Because von Rad hypothetically proposes that the structure of the book comes out of some sort of periodic covenant renewal ceremony held at Shechem in the Northern Kingdom, and still dates the thing late. He doesn't find any basis for Mosaic authorship in this structure. Now remember, I'm talking still about von Rad. In 1938, von Rad sold his structure before anybody knew anything about the Hittite treaties and the relationship between the treaty structure and Deuteronomy. Von Rad sold structure in the book. He says it's representative of a ceremonial, cultic kind of background to the book. He then hypothetically proposed there was some sort of covenant renewal festival that was held periodically. The book relates to that. It's not Mosaic. Now, of course, von Rad has had to, in recent years, relate his previous ideas to the new material on the Hittite Treaty. And I haven't discussed that yet. We'll come to that. Yeah.
Hadn't Mendenhall done any work before von Rad?
No, Mendenhall's article that started all this trend was 1954. So von Rad was 38, so it was 20 years later. Mendenhall's articles like that, he sort of initiated a whole area of study, but it took 10 years after 54 before it really got going. Now, like Klein's book came out in the early 60s, 63. And Klein was in pretty much in at the beginning of this discussion. Since 63, it's progressed even more, and it continues to. But you get a 20-year period of time now since Mendenhall's initial article. But that hasn't worked its way down and worked its way out, so to speak, to a tremendous extent as yet. Yeah.
How have the critics responded to Klein? Has there been a response yet?
It's usually ignored or sort of dismissed with a few comments. But I want to discuss that too, because there are a number of men, critical scholars, that work with the treaty stuff and come up with different conclusions. And it's worth at least looking at how they do that and what the reason for it is. Because there are a couple of turning points in that argument that I think Klein's on the right track with. I think that the implications of that, however, are so momentous for these people schooled in this critical way of thinking that they just can't accept it. And the whole house would crumble. So there's a strong resistance to adopting the direction that Klein did with it, which to me, on the you can't ever speak in terms of proof or anything like that, as far as Mosaic argument, Deuteronomy, with this kind of argumentation. But I think you can create a model that has a weight of evidence with it that speaks for itself in a certain sense when you put it over against the other models. And here's his model, here's Klein's, here's somebody else's. And I think ultimately, yeah, the integrity of the book, you're based on the claims that it makes for itself and the integrity of Scripture itself. And you know, you can debate all of these things back and forth. But I think that this line of argumentation has added a forceful line of argumentation to supporting the integrity of Deuteronomy as it claims to be for Moses. Yeah.
You said that this book was pretty much ignored. Does that seem to be the reception of most evangelical books?
Yeah, I'd say so. Particularly in the, you see, there may come a change, but presently, anything that gets a real hearing has to come out of Germany, it seems. And when you get, there's a whole different world of thought over there. When you get over there and in those circles, anything that's written in England or America, particularly America, is almost disqualified from the start, yeah. Or, you know, it's, well, some American like that, they won't even look at it. Now, of course, that's hardly fair or objective or anything of the sort, but there's a strong attitude like that. If something's going to be significant, it comes out of Germany. And, of course, I don't doubt that there's a certain amount of German national pride involved in that, but the seems to be the way it works. Yeah.
I didn't know the publisher of Klein's book that was in a class at Temple University, and they were talking about the Bible, and the professor at the beginning of the course just said to completely ignore anything that's come out of Zondervan or Urban Publishing Company.
Well, that's sort of what you're up against. Five of, so I guess we better stop. Klein has a very interesting comment on that. I'll get to that in the next class on the basis of the analogy which can be drawn between the suzerainty treaties of the Hittites and the book of Deuteronomy. And I had given you, I think, let's see, we've gotten down to 5 points. The fifth one being there's a certain formal similarity with Klein's idea and von Rad's, in that von Rad spoke of a unity and a structure to the book with elements composing that structure roughly the same as Klein does, but von Rad hypothesizes some sort of cultic setting as the origin of the form. Klein would propose that the origin of the form comes from the Mosaic covenant in the Mosaic era, as the Lord entered into covenant with his people at Sinai, and then for very real reason that covenant was renewed on the plains of Moab, and the book of Deuteronomy reflects that covenant renewal. Now, we're going to come back to von Rad later, but for the moment, just that point. Now, number six. To give you just a few of the details that Klein works out, and you'll read Klein, so I need not dwell on this at great length. But number six, Deuteronomy begins, as did the ancient treaties. Page 30 in Treaty of the Great King. Klein says, Deuteronomy begins precisely as the ancient treaties began. These are the words of that expression. You have very similar expressions in the treaty documents. So you have that formal similarity. Deuteronomy begins as did the ancient treaties.
Can I ask questions concerning the preamble? You make this God really isn't mentioned in the preamble, the first five verses of Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
And does he have a case
he would
be the great king?
Yeah, well, he would take Moses as a representative of the words of God. In other words, Moses is speaking for God. So that that becomes very clear. And in that sense, the Lord is speaking. These are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel. Moses is the theocratic representative. And it's precisely the issue that Moses, as that theocratic representative, the representative of the great king, his leadership is going to be terminated by approaching death, that there is need for renewal, so that the continuity of that leadership can be recognized and prepared for and perpetuated. We come to that shortly. But the question's a good question. But Moses, then, in a sense, is the representative of the great king, as he speaks. Again, these similarities you cannot push to any sort of identical kind of derivation. It's using a similar form, a similar structure, adapted for quite different reasons and purposes and with quite different content. You don't want to force in some sort of artificial way the structure of the treaties on the biblical material. It's much better to treat the biblical material itself in its own integrity, but to see that there's certain relationships. Number seven, Klein's approach resolves the two introduction problems. We discussed that earlier. Various critics have, in their analysis of the book, come to the conclusion there are two introductions and that the book is not a unity for that reason. That being one of the reasons. Also on page 30, Klein says, a major problem concerning the unity of Deuteronomy has been the presence of two introductions, chapters 1 to 4 and chapters 5 to 11. And it's often been said neither needs the other. They seem to be independent of each other. And I mentioned to you what Noth tried to do, to make the first of those two introductions the introduction to the Deuteronomic history as a whole, running from Deuteronomy to 2 Kings. The second one as an introduction to the book of Deuteronomy itself. He says on page 31, but Noth's view and every attempt to separate Deuteronomy 1 to 4 from an original core is contradicted. The supposed problem of the two introductions is obviated, and the real structure of Deuteronomy is further clarified by these facts. An historical prologue regularly follows the preamble. and precedes the stipulations in the suzerainty treaties. And Deuteronomy 1:5 to 4:49, the way Fine breaks it down, 1:5 to 4:49, qualifies admirably as such an historical prologue. So in the treaty analogy, 1:5 to 4:49, structurally corresponding to the treaty historical prologue. When covenants were renewed, the history was brought up to date. Agreeably, Moses takes up the narrative of Yahweh's previous rule over Israel at Horeb, Sinai, where the theocratic covenant was originally made. He carries the history to the present, emphasizing the most recent events, the Transjordanian conquests and their consequences. In other words, the historical prologue is updated, the point of renewal. He goes on then to say, the third division of the suzerainty treaty was the stipulation. Now, if you come in the treaty structure, you have the preamble, historical prologue, third is the stipulations. You remember those stipulations were divided into a basic, fundamental obligation, sort of summary, generalized, and then the specific, the detail. Klein says the third division of suzerainty treaties was the stipulations. And this division, Deuteronomy, can be readily identified with 5 to 26, chapters 5 to 26. Von Rad, as noted above, included chapters 5 to 11 with 1 to 4 as a historical survey. Those two introductions. In other words, of that 5 to 26, Von Rad has 5 to 11 still a historical survey. Others, separating 5 to 11 from 1 to 4, regard them as an introduction to 12 to 26. Klein's thesis then is, but Deuteronomy 5 to 11 must be recognized as expounding the covenant way of life, just as do chapters 12 to 26. Together they declare the suzerain's demand. The difference between Deuteronomy 5 to 11, 12 to 26 only represents differing treatments of this one theme. The former section, that is 5 to 11, presents no more, the former section presents in more general and comprehensive terms the primary demand for consecration to the Lord, both as principle and program. The latter adds the more specific ancillary requirement. So that
with any kind of division, you find the Hittite treaties of a presentation of a principal basic obligation. And 12 to 26, you would all include under his category of stipulations, the 5 to 11 being the broad general statement of obligation, to 12 to 26, the more specific obligation.